welcome to the Vancouver Institute. Once again, you're invited to stay after the lecture and have coffee in the lobby. Our speaker this evening is Dr. Christopher Friedrichs. Dr. Friedrichs was born in White Plains, New York. He received his undergraduate degrees at Columbia, where he graduated cum laude, and he then attended Princeton on a scholarship and received his doctorate there in 1973. His dissertation dealt with the society, government, and impact on a city in South Germany called Nördlingen between the years 1580 and 1700, which spans the 30 Years' War and, of course, a much larger period as well. He taught at Princeton before coming to UBC in 1973, where he's presently an associate professor in the Department of History. His many articles have dealt with the study of the 30 Years' War and the impact of early capitalism on Swiss and German city-states and on the Low Countries as well. He's written on bourgeois and urban society and its relationship to social conflicts. And his present research relates to the causes, characteristics, and consequences of such urban conflicts, which is directly related to his topic this evening, urban revolutions, past and present. Dr. Christopher Friedrichs.
A friend of mine who's in this audience said a few hours ago that you cannot possibly expect anyone to listen to a 50-minute lecture without allowing them the chance halfway through to stand up and stretch. But I don't believe that's one of the traditions of the Vancouver Institute, and I don't think I'm going to try to institute that. So you're just going to have to sit while I talk to you about urban revolutions. You know, historians are always talking about revolutions. We historians use terms like industrial revolution, agricultural revolution, scientific revolution, commercial revolution, diplomatic revolution, cultural revolution. Even more recently, historians have been talking about the sexual revolution. But most of the time, I must admit, when historians talk about revolutions, they have in mind the most common, conventional definition of all: a permanent or temporary overthrow of the existing system of government or society, achieved by violence, or sometimes only by the threat of violence, which establishes a new system of government, brings to power a group of people who previously had not been considered suitable for having any role in government or power. But it's not really just historians who think about revolutions. Everyone in this room has thought about revolutions, has some idea what revolutions are, how they take place, what they are like. It's interesting, though, how often when we think of revolutions, when we have a mental image of what a revolution is, how often we conjure up an image of cities. If I say the word French Revolution, you will have a kind of image in your mind of the city of Paris, of a huge mob of people storming the Bastille. You'll have an image of agitated political meetings. You'll think, of course, of the grim trip through the streets of Paris when victims were carted through the streets surrounded by a shouting mob up to the guillotine. If I say the word Russian Revolution, you will think of the city of St. Petersburg, or as it was later known, Petrograd, or even more recently, Leningrad. You'll think of the crowds of people marching on the Tsar's palace. You'll think of Lenin arriving at the railroad station and making his famous speech. You'll think of the Bolsheviks seizing power on a dark night in that city. Even more recently, to mention just one revolution still in progress, if I say the words, the revolution in Iran, you will think of the city of Tehran. You will think of blocks of people full blocks and blocks crowded with people demonstrating in favor of the Ayatollah or chanting insults in front of the American embassy. There's something about revolutions that makes us think of cities, of crowds, of barricades being thrown up and defended, of great government buildings being taken over by revolutionary crowds. You know, when Charles Dickens wrote that wonderful novel about the fate of some English people and some French people during the French Revolution, he did not call his book A Tale of Two Countries, but he called it A Tale of Two Cities. Now, for a number of years, I have been interested in the problem in the history of urban revolutions. But by this, I don't just mean revolutions that took place in cities, such as those I've described, but rather a special kind of revolution that was directed against the governments of cities themselves, where it was the city government itself that the revolutionaries overthrew. This is something we don't hear very much about today, and why we don't hear much about it today is something I hope to get to before the end of what I say. But it's something which did occur at certain times and in certain places in the past. And now the particular episodes in which I have personally been interested took place in Germany 3 centuries ago. And I'm going to tell you some things about these urban revolutions in Germany, and I hope you will find them of some interest. I'm sure you will learn a lot more about 17th century Germany than you normally do on a Saturday night. But in thinking about these German city revolutions, I want you also to try to think about them the way a historian would, as something, as episodes that are interesting not only for their own sake, but also for the light they shed, the contrast or comparisons we can make with the nature of revolutions and revolutionary situations in general. For revolutions against the city, or urban revolutions against the city government to take place, there must obviously be a city government that people are angry enough about, something so strong, so powerful, so entrenched, that people can think of no other way of voicing their discontent than engaging in revolution. There have been many cities with that kind of government in history, but rarely were more of them concentrated in one place than in Germany in the 16th and 17th century. Germany at that period was part of, the largest part of, something known as the Holy Roman Empire. And you may vaguely remember from your schooling, the Holy Roman Empire was that thing that was neither very holy nor very Roman and nor much of an empire, but it was instead a confederation, a federal state, consisting of hundreds and hundreds of principalities, duchies, counties, districts, and semi-independent cities, all under the general authority of someone known as the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, this emperor was politically weak, and the various duchies and counties, and also those cities, were considerably stronger politically than we normally expect cities to be. The rulers of these cities were people who answered only reluctantly the commands of the Holy Roman Emperor and generally paid no attention at all to the wishes of their fellow citizens. Now, all of this represents a whole way of life, a kind of community that's so different from the kind of communities in which we live, that I'm going to talk to you in some detail about one of these communities and how a revolution broke out there, as an example of the kind of urban revolution that I've mentioned. And that particular city is Frankfurt am Main. Back then in the 17th century, like today, it was a major commercial center of Germany, only it was a lot smaller. You only had to have a population of about 25,000 in those days to be a major commercial center. It was, like most European cities, surrounded by a wall, the big gate towers. The city of Frankfurt was governed by a group of people known as the patricians. Rich people, most of them who mostly lived off income, people, the kind of people we today would call coupon cutters, people who lived off their investments, also some merchants. They controlled the city council of Frankfurt. Now, the city council of Frankfurt had 43 members. If you think 10 members is a big city council, you know, people talk about whether we should go to 12 or 16. Well, that city council had 43 members. 30 of them were members of this group called the Patriciate. And then they had 13 hand-picked safe guys that they picked from the guilds of the artisans, the craftsmen, men that wouldn't make any trouble. The way vacancies were filled on this city council was as follows. When one member of the city council died, once you were on the city council, you had lifetime tenure, you see. And when you died, the other 32 picked out, they selected or co-opted the replacement. There was nothing like popular elections. Now, this system seemed to work quite well for a number of decades, but in the early 17th century, there was a period of general recession in Germany combined with a period of rising prices. And in that situation, the city government had fallen considerably into debt. But it had fallen into debt not just because of the economic situation, but largely because of mismanagement. In fact, the patricians liked to keep the city in debt, because as long as there was a city debt, they could make loans to the city treasury at high interest, and that would be a very nice source of income. So there wasn't too much incentive to getting the city debt wiped out. They had also instituted a number of taxes, temporary taxes, which somehow never succeeded in getting taken off the books again. And they had very brutal punishments for people who didn't pay their taxes. In 1603, the City Council of Frankfurt made an edict that people who didn't pay their taxes would either have to work on building up the city walls or be imprisoned. And in 1611, 8 years later, they revised the imprisonment conditions to allow, instead of merely bread and water, two hot meals a week for the people who were imprisoned for non-payment of taxes. Now, you can imagine what the attitude of the citizens of Frankfurt was regarding the financial policies of their city government. There was also the very embarrassing problem of what can best be translated as the petty cash tokens. The 43 members of the city council were allowed to have special tokens for legitimate petty cash expenses. If they had to entertain a distinguished guest to the community, they would give the innkeeper or the restaurateur the petty cash tokens, which he would then collect, he would then redeem at the city treasury. Well, people noticed that who was turning up at the city treasury to redeem these petty cash tokens? It was the wives of city council members, their children. According to some sources, even some of the Frankfurt prostitutes were seen redeeming the petty cash tokens. And that made the citizens wonder whether the petty cash was being administered in quite the right way. Now, there was also a much more serious problem in Frankfurt. That was the problem related to the fact that Frankfurt had the largest ghetto in Germany, the largest number of Jewish people living inside a German city. As you may know, Jewish people in that period lived in Europe under terrible restrictions, under great humiliations. They were locked into their ghetto at night. They were unlocked in the morning to go about to do their business. Street urchins could walk up to an old Jewish gentleman and demand that he take his hat off to them. On the other hand, the Jews of Frankfurt tended to be rather wealthy. As you may know, Jews in Europe at that period were generally restricted to only a few occupations, one of which was money lenders. And there was very little they were allowed to do with the money they received as interest, because once you received the interest payments, you weren't allowed to buy property outside the ghetto, you weren't allowed to buy a nice house in the country or anything like that. So there wasn't much to do other than keep on making that money available for loans. Now, the interesting thing is that the patricians of Frankfurt were very helpful to the Jewish community. And to make a complicated story simple, I will explain the following. Jews were allowed to lend money to poor citizens of Frankfurt at 12% interest, which then, as until about 5 years ago here, was considered very high. Now, the money that the Jews earned from this interest, they then relent to the patricians, but of course, since the patricians made all the laws, they insisted on a much lower rate of interest for their loans. The money that the patricians had then gotten at low interest rates, they then invested at high interest rates in city bonds. So you can see what was going on here. The poor people of Frankfurt were paying high interest to Jews who made money available at low interest for the patricians to borrow so they could again invest that at high interest in city bonds. You know, the people of Frankfurt, the citizens of Frankfurt, did not know all the details of what was going on. But they had enough of an inkling of what was being done to become increasingly resentful towards the patricians who ran the city government. Well, all of this went along until 1612, when an important event was about to take place in Frankfurt, the coronation of a new Holy Roman Emperor. And in the typical fashion of the times, the city council issued an edict to the citizens saying, during the weeks when this distinguished personality is in our community, nobody may do anything to disturb law and order, no street fights, no troublemaking. If citizens make any trouble, they may lose all their rights and privileges. Well, that was a kind of conventional statement. But in 1612, things had gotten so bad for the citizens that a group of them sitting around in their tavern said, wait a minute, what's all this business about our rights and privileges? What are these rights and privileges we're going to lose? Let's find out. And they went to the Holy Roman Emperor, who, as I said, was in the town, and gave him very respectfully a petition asking him to notify them of their rights and privileges. And he said, well, I don't know anything about this, ask the city council. So they brought a petition to the city council, and they said, oh, don't bother us with a thing like this. We're busy arranging hospitality for the coronation of the Holy Roman Emperor. And the thing was kicked back and forth the way petitions usually are. Finally, the citizens of Frankfurt got so annoyed that they formed a committee to demand information about the privileges. Now, privileges, everybody knew that the privileges of the citizens of Frankfurt were to be found in a great big iron box that was kept in a church tower where all the charters that had been granted over the years were located. So after this thing had gone on for about a month, a large group of citizens gathered in the marketplace. A delegation was sent in to speak to the city council and demand to see the box of privileges. And the city council got very nervous, went into recess, executive session, you might call it, came back out a few minutes later and said something the citizens did not expect to hear. The city attorney took the little leather bag with the key to the box with the charters, put it on a chair in the middle of the room, and said, those are the keys. You can take them, open the box. But the minute one of you raises fingers on those keys, we abdicate all responsibility for the affairs of Frankfurt. We will not cooperate with this interference with our responsibilities. We are going to leave the city, and if the city goes to hell in a handbasket, it's your problem and nothing to do with us. Well, this caused all the citizens to panic. All they wanted was to find out about their rights and privileges, not take over the city of Frankfurt. And they all fell onto their knees and begged the city council, which was by then very theatrically already marching out of the room, to come back, we didn't mean anything of the sort, come back, we didn't mean to do that, keep your keys, let's talk this over. So the city council had won the first round in this war of wits. However, they recognized that there really was significant agitation among the citizens, and they did agree to negotiate. 6 months later, they finally came to a settlement. The city council agreed to let the citizens pick 18 new members of the city council to be added to the 43, and also to establish, you know, the old committee system, establish a committee of 7 to go into that box of privileges, and a committee of 9 to check out the city's financial records. However, this all had to be done in secret. All the committee of 7 and the committee of 9 was allowed to do was to report its findings to the big expanded city council. Well, at first the citizens thought that might be a reasonable compromise, and for a year, the whole year, 1613, wound on with these committee of 7 trying to look into things and the committee of 9 trying to look at things. And every time they really thought they knew which important document they wanted to see, they got the runaround. They were told, well, now this particular charter is so confidential, we can't even let the committee of 7 see it. Or these particular tax books are so delicate in their implications that we cannot let the committee of 9 see it. And things went on. Then the citizens found out that one of the patricians was attempting behind their backs to have the Holy Roman Emperor come in and cancel this whole compromise and so on. They started withholding taxes. Now that got the city council rather nervous. So a year later, beginning of 1614, they instituted another compromise. The citizens would promise obedience, they would pay their taxes, and the council solemnly promised to expedite the process of providing the records that everyone was asking for. Well, that was in January of 1614. In May of 1614, nothing much had happened. The Committee of 7 and the Committee of 9 were still waiting to get the information they wanted, and finally, things came to a crisis. Under the leadership of a very charismatic man with the name of Vincent Fetmilge, a huge mob of citizens, this time something like 1,000, appeared once again in the marketplace in front of the city hall and demanded not only that the Committee of 9 be given more access to the financial documents, but also be released from its vow of secrecy and be able to make public what it had found out. To make sure that the city council agreed, 5 members of the city council were held hostage in various places around the city. And the city gates were attacked by the citizens and locked. No one could go in or go out until this matter was settled. Well, under these circumstances, you know, you've got to remember, cities like this didn't have a big police force. The city council couldn't call out the local police force because the local police force, in a sense, was the citizens themselves, the citizen militia, as it was called. So the city council gave way, and it allowed the Committee of 9 to make public its report. Well, the minute this Committee of 9 made public what they'd found out so far, it became evident that the amount of waste, the amount of peculation, the amount of stealing of city funds was much greater than anyone had imagined. City council members kept taking the fines that were levied on evildoers and putting them in their own pockets, as they said, in return for the services they rendered for the common good. Any number of unnecessary loans and unnecessary financial shenanigans were made clear, and there was an explosion of excitement by the citizen. The group of citizens once again locked the city gate, marched on the city hall where all 43 city council members were rather anxiously holding a meeting. In fact, all 43 old members and 18 new members of the city council were anxiously holding a meeting. And what the crowd did is they told the 18 new guys, you can go home. But the 43 old guys were told, were locked into the city council chamber and held hostage until they agreed to resign. Well, they had no intention of resigning. The food that was sent in to them by their families was poked and pushed by the citizens to make sure no secret messages were being sent in. But even so, 3 days later, the city council was still determined not to resign until finally the citizens came upon a very shrewd expedient. The city council chamber in which these 43 men were locked was located right over the furnace with which the city hall was heated. Now, this was a nice warm day in May, and they started putting more and more wood into that furnace, and the city council chamber got hotter and hotter and hotter, and finally, after a number of hours, all 43 members of the city council, all dressed, as you can imagine, in great black robes and fur-lined collars, which of course they wouldn't take off, they finally came out drenched in sweat and agreed to resign and left the city of Frankfurt. You can see how in the course of a year and a half, that awe and admiration for the city council had totally dissolved as it really became apparent what kind of people these were. So now who is running the city now that these 43 guys had gotten onto their horses and left town? Well, the 18 new members of the city council, plus that committee of revolutionaries that had launched this whole thing in the first place. Now that they'd seized power, what did they do? Well, like all revolutionaries, they had certain policies, certain plans. They immediately instituted a program of financial reforms, as you can imagine. They finally finished looking at all the privileges, by the way. Turned out all to be very dull and innocuous and not very informative, and mostly having things to do with whether millers could charge certain taxes on certain goods. But anyway, they also instituted a policy of forcing every member of the city, every person living in the city, to join one of the guilds. This was a form of democracy, to make everyone join a guild and be subject to the same kind of fellowship and controls that guild members were already subject to. But you know, like most revolutionaries discover, as most revolutionaries discover, their ideas of making the reforms and changes that they want to make are soon overtaken by the concern to protect the revolution from its enemies. They don't have much time to do all the things they want to do because there are people who want to reverse the revolution. Obviously, the 43 old patrician council members weren't just going to quietly go to their country estates. They started to send barrages of letters off to the Holy Roman Emperor in Vienna saying, you've got to put a stop to this. You are the emperor, after all. The emperor hated to get involved, but finally sent a mandate to the city ordering that the old city council members be restored. The commissioners of the emperor came to Frankfurt and demanded that everyone take an oath of allegiance to the old city council. No success. Everyone refused. Then they started demanding that servants and journeymen and apprentices report to them which of their masters were or were not willing to give this oath of allegiance. This made all these journeymen very nervous. These were guys who, guys who were working, weren't looking for permanent kind of job situations, hated to be kept put in a squeeze. And as they started to kind of comply with this, a group of people thought of a way to turn their attention away. A group of people went to the journeymen and said, hey, you're missing the point here. Don't you remember who's really made all the trouble in the city of Frankfurt? The Jews. And this was a kind of a way of getting them excited, a code word for working them up, and sure enough, their passions got roused and they started, yes, the Jews are to blame for everything, and they headed for the ghetto. And the Jewish ghetto of Frankfurt was attacked. Not only by the journeymen, of course, but as soon as it started by a whole group of citizens who, as you remember, had always kind of associated the economic advantages of the Jews with the economic power of the city government. Since the 43 patricians had left, the Jews were the people they turned to in their anger and frustration. There was an attack on the Jewish ghetto. About half of it was plundered, the other half was defended from by the Jewish residents, until finally, realizing they could not win, the Jews of Frankfurt assembled in the Jewish cemetery and were given 4 hours to pack whatever belongings they had saved and leave the city of Frankfurt. Now, a new additional group of people was added to the 18-man city council. It looked like they would continue to try to rule the city, but then came another message from the emperor. This time he was really angry. One reason being that the emperor also had a significant financial interest in the Jewish community, which was a major source of loans for the Holy Roman Emperor. So Vincent Fetmilch and his closest colleagues were officially branded as outlaws. That was a very serious thing in those days. That meant that not only could and should everyone arrest a person who'd been branded as an outlaw, but a person who failed to do so when he had an opportunity was, in a sense, implicated in the outlawry. People began to really get very nervous and lose their enthusiasm for the revolutionary cause. And more of them agreed to take the oath of allegiance to the old city council. And then, as so often happens in revolutions, someone who had been part of the revolutionary movement at the beginning was persuaded to arrest the charismatic leader of the revolution, Fetmilch, who was carried off and handed over to an imperial court. And the man who had done this got any number of privileges from the, he was made into a nobleman and got a great country estate and so on. So the revolution in Frankfurt collapsed about 6 months after it had reached its high point. All the new members of the city council quickly resigned. The old members of the city council came back in. A number of months later, there was a kind of a final settlement of the whole thing. First of all, the guilds, which had been thought of as being hotbeds of democracy, were abolished. The Jews were allowed to return to Frankfurt, and the losses they had suffered and the plunder of the ghetto were restored. A promise was made that the financial irregularities would be investigated. That promise, I might add, was never kept. And the ringleaders of the revolution were executed, as was typical, I regret to say, in that period. Not only were they executed, but their heads were placed on spikes on the main gate of Frankfurt as a lesson to anyone who wanted to do the same in the future. In fact, the chief revolutionary, Vincent Fetmilch, had his entire house torn down to the ground, and in its place was put a stone column with an inscription that said, "Let this be a reminder of what happens to people who make revolution against legitimate authority." Well, I've told you the story of Frankfurt in some detail because we have to kind of get into a different world and a different culture. I am not going to tell you the stories of all the other German cities that had revolutions. I only want to emphasize that very many of them did. In fact, I've located about 8 or 10 cities where exactly the same kind of hostage taking of the city council members until they agreed to resign or until they agreed to do exactly what the citizens demanded was a central part of the urban revolution. There was another dozen or so cities where things didn't go quite so far, but where there was continual agitation and conflict between the city, the citizens, and the city government. There was, in fact, the city of Frankfurt did not have even the most extreme revolution. That one happened to take place in the city of Cologne in the 1680s, and there was no religious issue there. Every last soul in Cologne was Roman Catholic, so no one had any religious antagonisms. But there was a lot of concern about the corruption of the city government. It really was a case where people discovered that the mayor of Cologne had been calling the city carpenters in to put new window sashes in his house and billing it to city, to the city treasury and so on. Well, this led to an explosion that led to the resignation of various city council members. Finally, a more violent explosion in which one member of the elite was actually executed by the revolutionaries. But just as in Frankfurt, after a month, after a period, in this case a period of a year and a half, the old city council came back, had people arrest the leaders of the Cologne Revolution. In that case, it was a ribbon salesman who, for 18 months, not only governed the city of Cologne, but actually took over the job of city council and did all the legal business for which he wasn't exactly trained. And then finally this guy was arrested, and there were more trials and executions, and even the same kind of column was erected on the site of his house that had been torn down. Now, Germany had particularly many revolutions of this kind. They were particularly common in Germany because, as I said, it was a federal state in which cities themselves were semi-independent and thus had very powerful governments that were a focus of resentment for the citizens. But other countries experienced revolutions of this sort too. Just to mention the most important other example, in France, which was actually a very centralized country with a very powerful king, there were also urban revolutions. There was one that took place in the city of Bordeaux in the 1650s, in the middle of a big civil war in France. The citizens of Bordeaux rose up and overthrew both all the royal officials who were doing their job in Bordeaux and all the municipal officials, and set up their own new system of government. Convinced that the ordinary citizens had long suffered from oppression from the judges and rulers who had made decisions that were always advantageous to the big economic interests, their main obsession was to reorganize the system of justice, make it possible for the little man to bring his complaints and grievances to the courts, and they actually totally transformed the justice system of Bordeaux. Other measures were undertaken to benefit the lesser citizens. I'll only mention one. The revolutionary government introduced an across-the-board rent reduction of 25% for all tenants in Bordeaux. There was a general feeling that landlords were charging too much. But as in the German examples I mentioned, also in this French example, after months of controlling the city, the revolutionaries realized that the old leadership group was going to come back. The King of France was not going to put up with this kind of activity. In their last attempt to maintain the control that they had achieved, these revolutionaries tried to drum up foreign support, as often happens in revolutions, and even toyed with the idea of breaking away from France entirely and establishing something known as the Republic of Bordeaux. But of course it didn't work. Eventually the king's army came, besieged the city, starved the citizens into surrender, and like many other urban revolutions, this one eventually came to end. Well, I think I've said enough about the 17th century. You've probably heard much more about the 17th century than you expected. But the question I hope you've been thinking about is how this kind of revolution compares or relates to other revolutions of a later day, and what in fact was revolutionary about these situations. Clearly, different as the society was, different as the times were, much that I have described will surely have struck a familiar chord. The deep resentments that people had about the abuse of power and authority. The feeling that people had that they had no access to legitimate political power. They had no opportunities to even voice their opinions. The frustrations they had, which spilled out into violence. The sudden, rapid collapse of a discredited regime after people had come to realize that it was not fulfilling the functions that a government is supposed to fulfill. Even the techniques of revolution, the taking of hostages, the picking of a scapegoat group, which is in some way associated with economic power and which seems to be an easy group to pick on. All of these are things that we have heard and learned about in revolutions, or even heard about in some of the most recent revolutions of our own time. But also the way in which revolutionaries begin to quarrel among themselves, the way in which some of the people who had begun the revolution want to go the last mile, and others say, we seem to have gone too far, let's pull back, and maybe even betray the revolutionary extremists before it's too late. All of these things apply just as much to, say, France in the French Revolution, or Russia in 1917, or Cuba 1959, or even Iran today, as they do to cities like Frankfurt in the 17th century. There's very much in what I have described that we recognize as part of the standard way in which revolutions take place. But there are also a number of obvious differences. Above all, these were urban revolutions. As I said before, not just revolutions that took place in a single city. Not just revolutions that took place in cities, but revolutions that took place in and were directed against the government of a single city. Now, some of the things that the citizens of Frankfurt were all agitated about back then in the 17th century are also familiar to us. We are aware of the problem of the abuse of government power. We are concerned with the possibility of corruption in government. We are concerned about the distribution of justice. I think a lot of people in Vancouver are concerned about rents and wouldn't mind seeing a 25% rent reduction. But who would think of launching a revolution against the city government to achieve changes of this sort? Of course, this would seem completely unrealistic to us. The idea wouldn't occur to anyone in our kind of society. Now, one reason for this is that we happen to live in a society which provides mechanisms for the orderly transfer of power in the city. But that's not really all of it. Because even in societies, of which, and as you know, most societies in the world today do not provide mechanisms for an orderly transfer of power, even in those societies, when there are revolutionaries, they don't tend to look to the city, to city governments, as the locus of power and as the source of authority and the people or the institutions to be overthrown in a revolution. If someone is going to think about revolution, he's going to think about revolutions on a very different scale. But in the 17th century, the city was a world unto itself in a way that we can hardly recapture. The city was a walled fortress surrounded by fortifications that protected it from attack from outside. More importantly, the city governments were powerful in ways we can hardly recapture. Just to go back for a minute to Germany, nobody paid taxes to that federal government called the Holy Roman Empire. They paid taxes to the city government, which might or might not pass on some of the tax monies to a higher authority. Nobody served in the army of the Holy Roman Empire. People served in the militia of Frankfurt, or the army of some local region, which might or might not serve in a broader war. No one expected the federal government of that time to protect his rights or regulate his economic affairs. Everything that people saw being done was done by the local government. If you wanted to know who had set your taxes too high, prevented you from opening a new business, denied you justice, failed to provide grain when there was a bad harvest, you would think about the all-powerful local mayor and alderman. Many of the urban revolutionaries, like revolutionaries before or since, were deeply idealistic. But their ideals were focused on their city, in the cases I've described, rather than on their country. This wasn't the only kind of revolution that took place in that period of history, but the examples I've chosen show you how it was possible for people to think about their city and nothing else as the institutions they wanted to have changed. They felt that if only Frankfurt or Cologne or Bordeaux could be made a better, more decent place to live, then that would be enough for them. Now, there was one even more extreme city revolution that had taken place a bit earlier. The religiously inspired Anabaptist millenarians of the 16th century who took over the city of Münster in northern Germany, who drove the established rulers and, in fact, most of the citizens out of that German town, and briefly turned the city into an egalitarian communistic republic. They saw this as a chance to separate an ordinary city from the rest of the world. They, in fact, called the city of Münster the New Jerusalem, a bit of heaven already here on earth. Well, like the other urban revolutions I've described, that particular bit of heaven on earth did not last too long either. And in fact, most urban revolutionaries of the 17th century were a bit more hard-headed and less apocalyptic than those that I've just mentioned. But they did believe, as it turned out, mistakenly, that they could make their communities into republics of virtue and justice, and this, if it had succeeded, would have been enough for them. And I emphasize that to show you the contrast between this kind of revolution and revolutions of a later period. I'm going to talk about two groups of later revolutions. First, those that took place in Europe from about the time of the French Revolution to the time of the Russian Revolution. These are all the great revolutions that you learned about at some point, whether the French Revolution, the revolutions of 1848, the Paris Commune, the Russian Revolution, and so on. And as I said right at the beginning, the urban element, the urban scenario, was extremely important in these revolutions. In fact, in the case of Paris and the French Revolution, we always think about the fall of the Bastille. But there was also a takeover of the city government of Paris, which was considered crucial to the success of the revolution. But the reason they wanted to take over the city government of Paris was not just to change Paris, but to use Paris as a base for transforming France as a whole. They were thinking on a national level, not on a city level. Exactly the same applies to the Russian Revolution, where control of Petrograd or Moscow was thought of as crucial and important, both for ideological and practical reasons, but primarily as a basis from which to take control of the entire country. Or if I can mention the most famous clearly urban revolution of the 19th century, something called the Paris Commune of 1871. This was something where after France had collapsed in a war with Germany and was making peace terms with Germany, a small group of people in Paris took over the city of Paris, tried to separate Paris from the rest of France, but not with the idea of making Paris into a separate republic, but rather of making Paris a bastion of radicalism in the great sea of French defeatism and reaction. They thought of themselves as forming a model for a better way for the rest of France to be organized and governed. In fact, people outside of France recognized this. They saw the Paris Commune as having to do not just with France, but with all of Europe. In the middle of the Paris Commune, there was a mass meeting in Hyde Park in London, at which a resolution was voted to send the Paris Commune a message of support, in which it was said, "We the people of London," of course not all people of London, but that's what they said, "We the people of London, believing you to be fighting for, not for Paris to be a republic of virtue or radicalism, but rather, we the people of London, believing you to be fighting for the liberty of the world and the regeneration of all mankind, express our admiration for the grandeur of your enterprise." This is what 19th century revolutions were about. They took place in the cities, But they weren't revolutions against city governments, they were revolutions conceived of as having much broader implications. An even greater contrast emerges if we look at the major revolutions of our own century. Take, for instance, the most important single revolution in the 20th century, the Chinese Revolution. Now, this was a revolution in which it was anything but true that the city was used as a basis for broader social change. Far from it. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, when Mao Tse-tung was beginning to become politically important in the 1920s, he got into a raging argument with other leaders of the Little Chinese Communist Party. They said, well, look, we know what happened in Russia. We know that the way you make a revolution is you take over the cities first. The way Lenin took over Leningrad and Moscow, and then you move on to the rest of the country. And Mao Tse-tung said, wait a minute, that may have worked for Russia, but it doesn't work for China, which is overwhelmingly a peasant society. And he forced through a different conception of revolution, the peasant-based idea of revolution. The important thing was to secure not control of the cities, but get control of the countryside. And that is maybe, as I'm sure many of you know, is exactly what Mao Tse-tung did. He took over certain regions in the countryside, peasant districts, made them powerful and strong, and gradually made them bigger and bigger. And the last things that followed the Chinese Revolution were the great cities like Peking or Shanghai. The cities were the end point of revolution, not the beginning. Very much the same could be said about the Cuban Revolution, where Castro began in the mountains and worked his way down towards Havana. Or the Vietnamese Revolution. If you look at the Vietnamese Revolution as a 20-year process, beginning in 1945 and ending in 1975, look where it ended. It ended in Saigon. I'm sure you all remember the pictures of the helicopters taking the last Americans away from Saigon. It wasn't a city as the basis for revolution, but rather the great capitalist city of Saigon as the last place to be taken over. Or an even more extreme example in Cambodia. We're all supposed to get used to calling Cambodia Kampuchea now, but I guess many of us have not yet. In Cambodia, when the Khmer Rouge took over in 1975, not only did they finally take over the city of Phnom Penh, the great capital city of Cambodia, but they proceeded to destroy it. They totally evacuated the city and sent the city people out to the countryside on the theory that only out on the great farms could people be true revolutionaries. It was the exact opposite of the vision of urban revolutionaries in the 16th and 17th century. Far from making a city into a new Jerusalem, the Cambodian revolutionaries felt they had to destroy the leading city of their country to make a city, make the revolution successful. Now, obviously, I've mentioned some extreme cases, but even if we look at revolutionaries of our own time, successful or unsuccessful, who are active in cities, who function in cities, we can see how unimportant to them the city as such is, particularly in their conception of what the future will be. Indeed, we even have situations where it's no longer the city or the country that is the focus of revolution. I recently heard from someone who had returned from Nicaragua, which, as you know, experienced a revolution about a year ago. They're still at the stage of revolutionary excitement where they have great mass meetings to follow the cause of revolution. And he heard people there, one person would say, you know, viva the Nicaraguan revolution, and the next person would say, viva the revolution in all of Central America, because people aren't, not only are they not thinking in terms of cities, they're not only not even restricting their conception to a single country, but thinking about revolution as something that crosses international borders. All of this, as you can see, is very, very different from the attitude of the urban revolutionaries that I was talking about before. But let us return from a brief mention of Nicaragua or the kind of things that are going on in El Salvador or elsewhere in the world to our own city of Vancouver. This is, after all, the Vancouver Institute, and I think it's safe to assume that most of you live, as I do, in Vancouver, and that most of us are people who care about this city and its government, its way of organizing itself and its future. As residents of a city, knowing both the satisfactions and the frustrations of urban life, I'm sure we have some understanding, not for the bigotry, but for the frustrations of 17th century citizens who felt so unable to cope with their city government and unable to achieve any of their aspirations in the framework of the existing system. This is something that some people are is not unknown to some people today. But who among us would seriously think that we could solve the city's problems by holding the City Council of Vancouver hostage on bread and water in an overheated council chamber until they came to reason? Because even if we could, anyone could thereby get Mr. Harcourt and his colleagues to leave City Hall and resign, it really wouldn't make any difference in terms of the way the community existed. Because after all, as we know only too well, it's not the city that can exist as a thing apart, as the focus of government and power and change. The city we recognize as being only a small part of the world in which we live. Virtually every concern that we may have, even about life in our city, ends up being referred to some other higher level of government. We're concerned about transportation, we're told, nothing to do with Vancouver, you've got to go to the GVRD. If we're concerned about housing, we say, well, it all has to do with central mortgaging policies. If we're concerned about building a convention center, we find that most of the money has to come from someplace outside the city. We have to look to the regional district or through the province or to Ottawa itself for the major issues to be resolved. For better or worse, we in the 20th century no longer live or function as exclusively in terms of our own community, as men and women often did in the 17th century. We still live in an age of revolution, even if we don't notice it very directly in Canada, but it's safe to say that we no longer live in an age of urban revolution. Thank you.
Professor Friedrichs has agreed to answer questions. Please keep them short and speak clearly. Yes, sir.
Sir, you told us the story of many unsuccessful revolutions. Was there not one succeeded?
That's a very important question. There were revolutions that succeeded in the 17th century, and I can refer to two categories. First of all, in some of these city revolutions that never went as far as the ones I've described, there was much more success. And then the only trouble is, it's not quite clear whether they should really be called revolutions. In other words, in cities that had similar experiences to Frankfurt, but where at some earlier stage the city councils were more reasonable, were more willing to make an authentic compromise, were more willing to protect their long-term power by admitting some changes and making some concessions,
There were situations where citizens, by the threat of violence, by threatening to hold them hostage or by making a lot of trouble, did achieve moderate reforms in city government. But as soon as anything got as extreme on the city level of government as the episodes I described, there were always some neighbors who felt, this threatens us. If this kind of, these kinds of people have control of a city, it's dangerous for us. Very much as if, as in the Russian Revolution, you know, as soon as the Russian Revolution took place, a lot of other countries felt this threatened them. That's why British and American and French, and for that matter, Canadian troops were sent to Russia to stop the Russian Revolution. So there's that feeling that neighboring powers get too nervous about it. And a city was not strong enough to withstand that kind of attack the way a big country like Russia could. The only revolution of great importance that was successful in the 17th century was not a city revolution, it was the one great national revolution of the 17th century, and that was the English Revolution. And even that wasn't completely successful. Oliver Cromwell and his group came to power, and but 12 years later, there was a restoration, and much of what they had achieved was once again reversed.
Yes, yes, sir.
I hope I got your question. You've asked me about theocratic revolutions. Well, I gave one example of perhaps the most famous theocratic revolution, which I just touched on, which was that famous Anabaptist Republic of Munster, a case where people got this idea that the German city of Münster was going to be the new Jerusalem. The interesting thing is that that revolution started as a city revolution very similar to the kind that I've talked about. It started, except that the big issue at that point in the 16th century, people weren't so concerned about corruption and economics and finances as they were about religion, because that happened to be the Reformation. And people went there and demanded that the city government let them worship in a Lutheran way and so on. And because the city government refused, there was this kind of challenge to the authority of the city government. But by a complicated process, then when the Lutherans took over, a group of Anabaptists said, and not just ordinary Anabaptists, but very extremist Anabaptists said, wait a minute, we don't want to stop with Lutheranism. We want this city to become a center of Anabaptism. Anabaptist Millenarianism, which is a very special group. And they succeeded in taking over. And then they attracted to the city people from other parts of Northern Europe who had this idea that this is where the new Jerusalem was going to take place. But it failed for the same reason that the other revolutions I've described did. People elsewhere felt too threatened by this highly egalitarian, communistic way of life, and they felt this would spread to other people and so on. And finally, in fact, it was one of the few things where Protestants and Catholics in Germany at that point agreed. They, despite all their quarrels, they agreed to send a united army to crush that revolution. Now, that's the most extreme theocratic revolution. I could make a comparison in the same framework, you see, to the things going on in Iran, which some people have called a theocratic revolution. But once again, in our century, a theocratic revolution does not take the same kind of urban focus. There's the holy city of so-and-so, the Ayatollah lives, there's the things that happen in Tehran, but no one would think anymore of kind of just gathering in one city in Iran and making that, you know, the holy city that all revolutionaries would be attracted to. People don't have the mentality today that lets them think that they can kind of cut themselves adrift from the rest of a country and just make a city a republic or a thing unto itself. That would, in a sense, be why a theocratic revolution would take one form in the 16th century and take a very different form in our own time.
Yes, sir.
I'm happy. having trouble hearing you. You're going to have to shout your key words nice and loud. Okay, you asked about parallels between some of the techniques that I referred to, taking of hostages and so on, with let's say more contemporary revolution. Well, in a way, I have to refer it again, let's say, although in a different context, to the Iranian case. But it is not an alien technique in our own world. And I need only cite the Italian example of Aldo Moro, which was carried out by revolutionaries in Italy. That group of people where revolutionaries border into or are terrorists. But again, they identified in that case as the person that they wanted to hold hostage, the key figure in Italian politics in general, the linchpin of the whole Christian democratic system in Italian politics, and they saw that kind of person as the hostage to be taken, because they were thinking in national terms rather than in a much narrower framework. So I think that what I was trying to suggest is that some of the techniques of revolutionaries, the way people in desperation or the way people with extreme ideas try to achieve their aims, some of their techniques are similar, but the entire focus or the targets they select might be very different today.
Yes, madam.
Well, it's okay. There are two points there. One is any kind of hostage taking represents a situation where conflict resolution has broken down. You know, where the channels that people recognize or acknowledge as the way in which to resolve a conflict have broken down, and it's very striking that, let's say, in the Frankfurt case. This didn't happen until 18 months of attempting to work things out, attempting to negotiate, attempting to resolve things. But I'm not too sure that, there's obviously a lot going on in the world today in terms of calling for decentralization, often in an ethnic framework, separatism. I mean, Canada is the least of it. I mean, you look at Spain or Belgium, any number of countries where people say, look, people will work better if they are in smaller units that reflect their own cultural heritage and so on. But I don't think that this would necessarily defuse certain political situations, because there are always going to be people who, whether they're dealing with a large or a small political unit, feel frustrated. And so to my mind, it's not so much the size of the units that are significant, because all that's going to affect is whom people select as their targets. The real issue is effective techniques for giving people a sense that peaceful change is possible. I mean, this is why we in a democratic system. Another reason no one has taken the Vancouver City Hall is because
People can do it by the ballot box. I'm sure there are people in this room who feel that what happened in November was, in its own way, an urban revolution, but if so, it was done through a recognized mechanism. So I think that that's really the key to these situations, is having mechanisms that prevent people from feeling this is the only way out or the only way to achieve their aims.
Perhaps that's a good spot to end the questions. And I'd like to ask Dr. Robert Kubicek, head of the Department of History, UBC, to thank Dr. Friedrichs on our behalf. Let me remind you that you're all invited to stay for coffee outside. Next week, you're invited to hear Dr. Richard Blandow of the University of Washington on the threat of overpopulation.